You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Alec Baldwin described the terrible conflict of great acting thusly. You have to be free to jump off into that volcano, and you have to be pathologically self-conscious.
So what you're saying is Alec Baldwin's turn as club owner Dennis Dupree in Rock of Ages is definitely going to make your list of the top five performances of the year so far.
To answer that, I would have to subject myself to Rock of Ages, and my commitment to the show only goes so far.
Oh, come on.
Sorry.
Well, we'll see what performances did make our list a little bit later in the show. But first, in Seth MacFarlane's Ted, Mark Wahlberg can't let go of the teddy bear that came to life when he was a young boy. Now, Josh, I had a Cabbage Patch Kid named Christopher. Any childhood attachments you want to confess to?
I left the Cabbage Patch Kids to my little sisters, Adam.
How
sorry.
Dare you?
I'm sorry.
Forget George Lucas. Why are you destroying my childhood?
Listen, I'd love to hear more about Christopher. Bonus content?
It has been said that magic vanished from our world a long time ago. But if there's one thing you can be sure of...
I wish you could really talk to me.
It's that nothing is more powerful than a young boy's wish.
You're my best friend, John.
I love you.
But eventually, everyone grows up.
I'm taking Laura to dinner. You don't think she's going to be expecting something big, do you?
It's been 4 years, Johnny. You and me have been together for 27 years. Where's my ring? Huh? Where's my ring?
What are all my fuzzy fingers? Where's my ring? Come on.
Knock it off.
All right, I'm just saying.
Judd Apatow's presence in the movie comedy landscape is so ubiquitous. And Josh, this is the point where you're supposed to jump in and say, how ubiquitous is it?
How ubiquitous is it?
Judd Apatow's presence in the movie comedy landscape is so ubiquitous that I'm invoking his name, even though, as far as I can tell, he had absolutely nothing to do with Ted, the film directing debut of Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane. Apatow, of course, has been maligned by some over the years for his focus on male protagonists who just need to grow up, and often do, usually thanks to the love of a girl who deserves someone far better. From Steve Carell's collectible-loving 40-year-old virgin to Seth Rogen's stoner Mr. Skin wannabe and Knocked Up, the karate-chopping, drum-playing duo in Step Brothers, which Apatow produced, and on and on. Though in fairness, I'm not sure Apatow should get either the blame or the credit for the prevalence of the arrested adolescent male on screen. I mean, surely we can also point to Diner and Swingers and a good chunk of Bill Murray's best work, including Meatballs, Stripes, and even Ghostbusters and Groundhog Day. Which brings us back to Ted. The story of a 35-year-old rental car company employee played by Mark Wahlberg. John's content to sit around his house all day, get high, and crack vulgar jokes with his teddy bear. A teddy bear that walks and talks and procures the services of prostitutes, just like any normal dude, after a boyhood wish that miraculously came true. Josh, has Seth MacFarlane succeeded in taking the movie man-child to his logical, laughable extreme, offering us a hero who doesn't just harbor a soft spot for his furry BFF, but who actually needs his thunder buddy to comfort him when a storm hits? Or is he covering all too familiar, unfunny ground, just with a lot more CGI?
He's covering familiar ground, and as a matter of fact, you could take Jason Segel and put him in the place of the bear, and the movie wouldn't really skip a beat. By that I mean, and I liked this about the movie.
It's the Muppets.
Well, yeah, it is the Muppets story, for sure. The setup, the first, like, 15 minutes.
MacFarlane had to hate that when the Muppets came out.
If you didn't go to the Muppets because it was a little too gentle for you, but you like the idea, this will be for you.
Yeah.
But I think you could really put Siegel in this movie, and it wouldn't skip a beat. And
no.
I liked that later on because they don't really acknowledge that this is a bear after a little while.
Right.
They kind of get it out of the way. The world has come to accept this. And I really like the scenes of Wahlberg and this bear together where they're not doing anything differently than in something like I Love You, Man.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that it is a bear, though, of course, adds that extra level of comic bite. And so it worked for me. I mean, this isn't – The Muppets is much more clever on this theme, even though there are so many similarities. It, you know, comes to the montage of the bear and Wahlberg growing up together, as we saw Siegel and Walter growing mm-hmm. up together. It has a marriage proposals at the heart of this, whether or not Wahlberg's going to kind of break out of his adolescence and move on as a man. So, yeah, it's the same story. The Muppets does it in a much more clever way. But there's a lot of good moments here, and I did think it works. It's an interesting variation on that whole genre you're talking about.
Well, I'm really disappointed. For whatever reason, I just thought this movie would not mesh at all with your sensibility. Maybe it's because I just think you're kind of a goody two-shoes, Josh.
I don't know.
But I thought you would not go for this movie and we would have a nice fight on air. As it turns out, I really like this movie, maybe a little bit more than you, but I think it's really funny. And I like that you bring up how they deal with the bear. And once it's introduced and we understand that the world has accepted that there's this talking, walking bear, then we move on from it. And I was actually able, thanks to the CGI, which is pretty incredible here, once it comes to life and they present it, we buy it, and you can then go on with the film and just accept Teddy as another character. He could be another character from one of the films you mentioned rather than being a bear that's come to life. So I thought that was pretty impressive, actually, where I was able to buy into the story and not be constantly thinking about the absurdity of the situation, which it certainly is absurd. There's only, for me, probably one egregiously unfunny bit in the film, and that's really any scene involving Ted once he moves out and gets his own dingy apartment. He has an Asian neighbor, and there's not a lot of scenes with the Asian neighbor, but none of them are funny. And frankly, as I was thinking about why those scenes weren't funny, it occurred to me that they may not work because it's a case where Seth MacFarlane actually doesn't push the offensiveness far enough. They're pretty cliche and toothless scenes and gags. And when MacFarlane, I think, is at his best, it's when he's pushing things so far that you laugh, and then you laugh at the fact that you're laughing. You can't believe they went there and that you find it hilarious. And there is a key example, a big scene near the end of the movie that I won't go into detail about because, A, it would ruin the joke, and B, if I explained it, I'd get a ton of hate mail. But it's really the emotional climax of the film. And rather than milk it for all it's worth and give us a nice feel-good moment, MacFarlane completely subverts it. And he left me not only laughing, but I was shaking my head at my own twistedness. And there's genius there in being able to make you recognize how terrible a human being you just might be and still laugh about it.
Well, if you want me to play goody two-shoes, I'll bite on this. The Asian character is a real weak point here, and it's also reflective of a thread that's going through it, which is general xenophobia I detect in a lot of this humor. There's genuine fear, misunderstanding.
But they know they're being xenophobic.
Okay, but
so it's ironic.
But then if you're going to go there, give me some good material, and maybe it's the case you're saying is push it further so that you're aware of it. There's also a lot of homophobia here that's repeated throughout, and again, it's very easy. It's very obvious. It's the gay gag to go for. And that's where it kind of ends. And so this is my first impression of MacFarlane. I not watched Family Guy, and so I know very little about him. And it struck me as I could detect that vibe under there. Maybe if it had been pushed farther, the way Sacha Baron Cohen sometimes, not in The Dictator, which is terrible, but before that, will push these things so far that we start thinking about why we're laughing.
Exactly.
But here, when those moments are on, it doesn't go that far, so they're just lazy, racist, and homophobic jokes. That's how I took them.
Oh.
Laurie, hey, you're home early.
This place is a wreck. Who are these girls?
You know, they're hookers, so it's fine.
What the hell is this?
Oh, my God, where are my manners? Laurie, this is Angelique, Heavenly, Shireen, and Sauvignon Blanc. I love you girls. You know, somewhere out there are four terrible fathers I wish I could thank for this great night.
I think it's worth noting, I'm glad we got to it, because I think Ted is getting a free pass for a lot of that in the name of crudeness. You know, oh, well, that's MacFarlane. He just does that. Oh, it's a crude R-rated comedy. They're going to have that. I think it's worth pausing and thinking about why does it have to be there? Now, that being said, McFarlane did very much surprise me in the emotional content that is in this movie as well. There are a lot of sweet moments.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give a lot of credit to Wahlberg and to Mila Kunis, who plays his girlfriend. And it's not the Harridan part where you see in a lot of the Apatow movies, not all of them, but a lot of them, where the girlfriend is just there to be the troublemaker, to be the problem between the two guys. In this movie, and Kunis is, gets a lot of credit for this, she brings a lot of depth and humor to the part. She is an equal in this three-person or two-person and one bear relationship. I mean, you understand why Wahlberg's character is torn about where to go. He has this loyalty to the bear, which mm-hmm. is really genuine because Wahlberg is good in those scenes with the bear. And he also has some really sweet moments where he and Kunis's character, they make each other laugh, they're enjoying each other's company, and you see why he's torn. Because he has fallen for this woman, and he could have a good life for her. So there's a lot of emotion at play here, too. That, for me, came as a big surprise when, otherwise for McFarlane, I just know the clips of Family Guy, which they always emphasize, you know, the crudeness. So that was pretty much what I was familiar with, but there's a lot more to this movie than that.
Hey, Johnny, how about a beer, huh?
Ooh, a couple Charles Bukowskis.
A couple Brustoyevskis.
Maybe a Mike Brugoslawski.
Perhaps a Teddy Bruski.
That's a good one.
You know what? I think I too want a Martina Navratilovsky.
Oh, no, that doesn't work. Don't ruin it. No.
That totally works.
No.
Yeah, it does.
Well, it doesn't work. The name has to have a ski at the end of it, and you just put Bruski at the end of Martina Navratilova, so.
Well, I just thought we were saying funny names.
No, it has to have a ski at the end of it. Otherwise, where's the challenge? You know, if there's no ski at the end of the root word, then we would just be idiots saying nonsense.
You're listening to Film Spotting, Adam Kempinar and Josh Larson. The movie we're talking about is Ted. It's the feature film directing debut from Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane. I'm with you on Mila Kunis as the love interest here, insofar as she does the best she can with a part that I think is otherwise still a little bit of a weak part. And you think back to some of those Apatow love interests, there's no doubt that he would get a lot of criticism often for the fact that you just couldn't quite buy that she's hanging out or interested in this schlubby character. And here, it's as if McFarlane anticipated that criticism a little bit, because obviously one key difference is Mark Wahlberg is, let's say objectively, a better looking man than Seth Rogen. So the whole looks part doesn't really apply here. We can see Mark Wahlberg and Mila Kunis being together in some universe. It's more that she's actually ambitious and seems to have a decent head on her shoulders, and she's dating a guy for 4 years who doesn't seem to be going anywhere, like a lot of those Apatow characters. So it is hard to buy a little bit that they're together. And I think, as I said, McFarlane anticipates that a little bit and tries to give us many scenes where we see them interacting and we see that sense of humor and that chemistry, and we can buy a little bit more easily that they would be together. Of course, it helps that she does at one point say he's hot too.
Yeah, so I was going to say, she comes out
and just says, look, I think he's hot. So that's another way that McFarlane gets around it. I think she is pretty good here, and I like that storyline. But I agree with you. I really, really like Mark Wahlberg in this performance. I think he's as good as he's been in a while, and this is when that Wahlberg natural earnestness pays off, because it perfectly balances all the ridiculousness. When you have a movie like M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, that's even more earnest than Wahlberg is, and that's when you get problems. So I think there's a perfect balance here with Wahlberg in this role. And in fact, I'll say it again, I said it on Twitter over the weekend, for me, a scene of the year candidate is the scene where Mark Wahlberg is sitting on the couch, probably just getting high with Teddy, and Teddy talks about his day at work. He meets a new cashier and says she's pretty white trashy, and Wahlberg thinks he can guess her name.
Mandy.
Nope.
Marilyn.
Nope.
Brittany.
Nope.
Tiffany.
Nope.
Candace.
All
right, speed round. I'm going to rattle off some names, and when I hit it, buzz it, okay?
I will tell you.
You got me?
Yeah.
All right, Brandy, Heather, Channing, Brianna, Amber, Sabrina, Melody, Dakota, Sierra, Bambi, Crystal, Samantha, Autumn, Ruby, Taylor, Tara, Tammy, Lauren, Charlene, Chantel, Courtney, Misty, Jenny, Krista, Mindy, Noelle, Shelby, Trina, Reba, Cassandra, Nikki, Kelsey, Shauna, Jolene, Erling, Claudine, Savannah, Casey, Dolly, Kendra, Kylie, Chloe, Devin, Emily, Luke, Becky?
Nope.
Wait, was it any one of those names with a Lynn after it?
Yes.
I got you. Okay. Brandy Lynn, Heather Lynn,
Tammy Lynn.
Ah!
That, for me, that killed me. I seriously
That's
did.
A good
not
scene.
Only is it funny, but the way Wahlberg delivers
oh, yeah.
all those names is genius.
He's got great comic timing. I mean, we've seen it in things like Date Night, The Other Guys, which is really one of the better Will Ferrell comedies, even though it's kind of been forgotten. Wahlberg really has great comic timing. There's a lot of priceless reaction shots here. And think of the load he's got to carry when he's dealing with what's pretty much a CGI bear.
Right.
There's seamless interaction with this bear in the scenes where he's reacting to what the bear says at the right moment and getting laughs out of that. However they pulled that off and put it together, a lot of that work is Wahlberg's, especially the knockdown fight they have.
It's brilliant.
That just keeps going on
yeah.
and on and reaches new levels.
It's almost a They Live Carpenter-like sequence, and it's beautiful because there's no dialogue.
No, music, no music either. Did you either. Notice that?
Yes, it's I did. Just, That's why it's just, so brilliant. Yes. It's just like it just goes into it. They just treat it as seriously as any serious moment in cinema history, this knockdown, drag-out fight, and I loved it.
It gets more vicious and more vicious. And again, I would love to know how they made that with Wahlberg. I mean, he's getting pummeled in the face repeatedly,
right.
and it's a great scene. And again, Wahlberg makes a lot of that work. A lot of what I appreciate about Ted, by saying they play it straight with the bear, maybe gives the impression that there aren't as many outrageous gags in here, but there actually are. They're just almost on the sidelines. And I think that fight is one of them. It just bursts out
right.
of nowhere. But there's other little moments. I love this shot early on when they're showing the montage of Ted and John growing up together, and eventually they're on a horseback riding trip, and you just see down there
He's
that Ted is riding a German
a
Shepherd.
Oh, it's a dog.
German
okay.
Shepherd. You know, I like that. There's a repeated Tom Skerritt gag that
yeah,
really
which
makes
is funny.
No sense, but it's hysterical, and they bring it back at just the right moments. So there's a lot of absurdities going on here, too, that I appreciated.
There definitely are, and I think that one of the things that stood out for me here, and this is kind of my first exposure to McFarlane as well. I've certainly watched a number of episodes of The Family Guy, but I wouldn't call myself a disciple. But like the South Park guys, you can't just write McFarlane off, I think, as a vulgarian because he's a really clever vulgarian. And they both play with serious or at least semi-serious themes. There's always an undercurrent kind of running underneath. And I think here, one of the things that McFarlane is at least playing with is this idea about how easy it is for most of us to discard something that was once the most important thing in the world to us, whether it's a toy or a band you were obsessed with or an author, whatever it might be. I think that McFarlane does express an ambivalence because he himself is clearly obsessed with American popular culture, while at the same time he seems to acknowledge that American pop culture is completely disposable. And I loved how we see the more obsessed you are with it, the more damage it can cause. I mean, there's a brilliant gag in the film where Mark Wahlberg is reflecting with Mila Kunis on their first date, how they met each other on a dance floor. And she tells her version of the story, and he's horrible and knocks her down because he can't dance. In his version of the story, it's a shot-for-shot remake of Airplane,
mm-hmm.
right? But there's something more to it than just the clever reference. There is something about the fact that I think for a lot of us who are probably too plugged in and too obsessed with pop culture and movies in particular, it's very easy for us to start to almost in a cable guy kind of way. I thought about this being the Muppets meets the cable guy. It's hard sometimes to have a genuine reaction to something without funneling it through your pop culture decoder and thinking about how a certain movie character dealt with a similar situation.
Yeah, that thread is there, but this is also where I want to reel you back in. When you start talking about the South Park guys, Trey Parker, Matt Stone, something like Team America, World Police, and Sacha Baron Cohen's work, those are hilarious, crude. They're funny because of the way they use vulgarities, but also they're working on the level of satire. And that's
yeah.
where I don't see McFarlane working at least in terms of Ted. What
I certainly
I've seen
don't think
here.
He's pushing it
and
as
it's,
directly
well,
as they
and,
are.
And so no. what I'm saying then is they're using those vulgarities and the crudeness in the context of a larger goal, and they all play together. Team America World Police has a very comparative scene, the one with the dolls where they're reenacting the standard Hollywood sex scene.
Right.
And it just keeps going crazier and crazier. And there's a satirical point there. Here in Ted, the bear is working as a grocery checkout guy, grocery checkout bear, I guess, and he's trying to hit on another checkout girl down the lane. and he starts doing these crude gestures to her to try to attract her. And it keeps getting more crude. And it reminded me of that Team America scene.
Okay.
But do you see the difference there? It's just kind of it's like the gag is like, okay, what crude thing are we going to do next? There's not a level of satire.
You're right.
I'm not saying that it bothered me or that, you know, but there's this level of sophistication that Ted doesn't have that some of these other comedians working have shown me.
I'm not sure I agree with you because I do feel that you're right in saying there isn't a direct satirical correlation to those scenes as there is in Team America. But I think there is perhaps a meta correlation in the fact that I think McFarlane is trying, as that scene gets cruder and cruder, to throw it back on us, the viewer, and force you to deal with the fact that you find that really funny.
Like
even though it's really offensive.
Like,
and
where
really
are you
dark.
Gonna stop laughing and gonna go, oh,
exactly.
Transition from the laughter. Right.
I think he is playing with you in almost a breaking the fourth wall kind of way.
Yeah, I get that. And that's why that's not one of the problem scenes. I guess I'm just bringing it up as a point of comparison. But when he does start playing around with the gay jokes and with the racist one-liners that are tossed off really casually, that's where I think we got to start saying, okay, what's the motivation here? Why is this in here? Why are we laughing? That's where there's some self-reflection that needs to be taking place that I don't think the movie is necessarily doing. That's a little more bothersome to me.
I think that self-reflection is there in going for those obvious cliche jokes. I think he's acknowledging that we know that's a standard place to go. So I think he's playing with it a little bit. And the bottom line is, with anything that's offensive, Josh, I think that you can get away with anything as long as it's funny. That will excuse a lot. And I think that there are some moments here that unfortunately aren't. And so they are just sort of seemingly racist or homophobic. But then there's way more that are genuinely funny. And I think he knows. I think he knows. There's a sense of irony to those jokes that works for me.
I'll just say the problem with that theory that you can get away with anything if it's funny is that funny to who? I mean, now you're starting
totally
to wonder. And it may be funny to you. It may be funny to me. But when you're getting into areas where someone from a different background or a different life experience or whatever it might not find it funny, then, you know, you need something else besides the outrageousness going on for it to work, at least for me.
I don't need anything more than the outrageousness and the fact that it made me laugh.
That's probably why you like Ted better then.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts, any other notes about the film that you didn't get a chance to touch on?
Just, you know, minor complaints. The whole Giovanni Ribisi storyline is kind of unnecessary. I liked how it started. He plays this guy who's now a father, but he grew up. He's the same age as Wahlberg's character,
and
he loved
Ted.
He wanted Ted. So he shows up in the park with his son now and is really creepy, offers to buy Ted. That's a great scene, and I thought it was just a cameo, but it kind of develops into this thriller thread that never quite works.
No.
And the whole movie kind of stumbles to an ending partly because of that. But, you know, you're here for the humor of it. That is, in most instances, a strong point.
That's a note I had as well. It seems as if McFarlane needs a plot crisis to drive things to the end of the film. It does seem a little bit out of place. It doesn't pay off really in terms of the humor or as any kind of thriller. But I'll give McFarlane credit. He makes quick work of it. The movie doesn't really get bogged down with it. I had this sense watching it that, oh man, where is this movie going and how long are we going to spend resolving this? I don't think he spends very long resolving it. It's just there to get us to the end of the film. The other note I had is that I'm guessing, speaking of pop culture and how obsessed you are with it, and certainly a nostalgia factor, for anyone who didn't grow up like me, loving the movie Flash Gordon and watching it 300 times, this movie may not work for you as well as it did for me.
There's a lot of Flash Gordon.
But if you loved Flash Gordon, then I think you just might love Ted.
Probably.
Okay, well, Ted is out now in theaters everywhere. If you get a chance to see it or you've seen it and you agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and over at Facebook, facebook.com/filmspotting.
Since Magic Mike and his boys got all the attention last week, we'll let the women go first in our discussion of the best performances of the year so far. Massacre Theater and part one of the Film Spotting Top 5 are next. Stay with us.
Now there's a singer everyone has heard. At night he turns into a mockingbird. If I whistle in the dark, he'll do that too. I've met him on the road at the close of day. He talked like me, he walked this way. I said, mockingbird, you ain't knowing a victor. And there's a singer everybody knows. He makes a rounds in the late night. the shoulders and shake her hand, and the host and the masquerade is on. You turn him off on the radio when you sing. Shoot out the lights and my shadow's gone. Down at the bottom of the calendar page.
Zamanlar Anadolu'da dersin, Jura bir yerde görev yaparken işte böyle böyle bir gece yaşamıştık dersin. Anlatırsın yani, ne bileyim, masal gibi.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Campanaro, and that was a scene from, according to us anyway, one of the best films of the year so far, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. We did that for all of our Turkish listeners out there. We know via podcast there are a ton of them. Actually, we've gotten emails, Josh, from a few listeners in
Turkey. I believe it.
So they are there. And that's a film that last week on the show did get a lot of praise. Myself, Michael Phillips was our special guest from the Chicago Tribune. We both had it at number one. You had it as your number two film of the year so far. And if you didn't get a chance to hear that show, you can do a search in iTunes or go to filmspotting.net. It's podcast episode 403. We'll get to our favorite performances of the year so far just a little bit later in the show. But first, it's time for Massacre Theater, everyone's favorite part of the show, where we perform a scene from a screenplay and you get a prize. Last week, with the help of Michael Phillips, we massacred this scene.
What's his name?
Brett.
What?
Yeah.
You see, I don't have to worry about you. What was he before he became a dog?
Well, he gets upset when people he doesn't know follow me home.
Come on, Grant, this is the man that feeds you.
Tell you what. Tell him I'll bring him a doggy bag if you have dinner with him.
Nick, I told you I don't think it's a good idea to go out with the boss.
Okay. Have it your way. You're fired. I'll pick you up tomorrow at 8.
That's Jennifer Beals as Alex, Michael Nuri as Nick, and Jumbo Red as Grunt the Dog from 1983's Flashdance.
Where did you find out that it was Jumbo Red?
I went back. I realized it was a three-character scene. Michael gave a brilliant performance
amazing.
The dog. It was amazing. And I went to IMDb, and sure enough,
he's
Jumbo
listed?
Red is in the credits.
Wow.
Yeah, he's there. Flashdance was directed by Adrian Lyne. The screenplay, Tom Headley and one Joe Esterhaus. And I didn't spend a ton of time looking at IMDb today, Josh, but Adrian Lyne, Joe Esterhaus. How did those two not collaborate like 27 times? Talk about a marriage made in heaven.
Must have figured they could never top Flashdance.
I guess so. But I just couldn't believe, though, that the guy who made Showgirls and the guy who made Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction, that somehow they didn't collaborate again on a film after Flashdance. We did get a nice explanation of the tie-in to last week's show from Aaron Hammond in Caledonia, New York.
The connection being that this film, like Magic Mike, deals with an exotic dancer who wants to do more with her life. Also, it stars a performer with limited range in Jennifer Beals. The fact that she played Daphne in Devil in a Blue Dress is an example of some of the worst miscasting ever. Michael displayed more range playing a dog than Beals did in 20 years of acting.
Ouch.
Wow. And Channing Tatum, too.
That's true.
He's just knocking him down all over the place.
How much range Channing Tatum has or potentially will have as he goes on with his acting career. He, of course, the star of Magic Mike. But yeah, a lot of listeners decided to use this as an open forum to just trash Jennifer Beals. I like Jennifer Beals, but the fact is, if you do go back and watch scenes from Flashdance, which I did in order to try to find a scene from Massacre Theater, you do realize she's pretty limited.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, every scene is just her getting really angry and just yelling at Michael Nuri a lot. So there's not a whole lot going on with her performance in Flashdance. Thank you, Aaron, for that explanation. Josh, I'd say reach into the brimming film spotting hat to pick out the winner, but the fact is, it's not brimming at all. I had a feeling this might happen. Maybe there are listeners out there that don't fully appreciate the genius of Flashdance the way I do.
Maybe they just couldn't hear the rest of the dialogue over Michael
barking.
Phillips yapping. That could have been the problem.
That could be it. I also think we did pick a fairly hard scene in that there wasn't anything about it that really gave away the notion
True.
Of flash dancing. And apparently we did stump most of Film Spotting Nation. So, Josh, pick out the winner.
The winner, a well-earned win then, goes to Jeremy Fritsch from Stevens Point, Wisconsin.
Congratulations, Jeremy. Email feedback@filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prize.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York, terrific.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by our friends at Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
And this week's winner will get a complimentary 6-month subscription to Fandor. I don't think we're going to have to give a whole lot of explanation here with this scene. I think folks will probably get the tie-in pretty quick to this week's show. That's all we're going to say. Josh, you started off. Are you ready for this one?
Let's do it.
Okay, I'm going to give you the action. And action.
You know something? It hurt. It hurt like a son of a bitch. Even bled. Now why is that?
You're turning human.
What?
More time you spend in that body, more human you become.
You mean I have to live out the rest of my life in this body? No effing way! You got me into this, you get me out!
Can't do that.
Why not?
Because you're an abomination. An outrage against nature. You perverted everything I taught you and you used it for evil. And you have to be stopped.
And scene.
I think that was an abomination.
Yes.
Actually.
Accurate. Although I'm kind of in suspense. I don't know what's going to happen.
What is
going to
happen?
Big things are coming.
If you know what film we just brutally massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, July 10th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You realize, of course, that we can never be friends.
Why not?
What I'm saying is, and this is not a come on in any way, shape, or form, is that men and women can't be friends because the sex part always gets in the way.
That's not true. I have a number of men friends and there is no sex involved.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
You only think you do.
You're saying I'm having sex with these men without my knowledge?
No, what I'm saying is they all want to have sex with you.
They do not.
Do too.
They do not.
Do too.
How do you know?
Because no man can be friends with a woman that he finds attractive. He always wants to have sex with her.
So you're saying that a man can be friends with a woman he finds unattractive?
No, you pretty much want to nail him, too.
Yes, I'm afraid it is true, Meg Ryan. Everything Billy Crystal just said in When Harry Met Sally is true. Let you in a little bit on the psyche of a guy. Of course, those great words written by Nora Ephron, who passed away last week, and we wanted to pay a little bit of tribute to Nora Ephron with this poll question. Who is your favorite Nora Ephron couple? Your options were Harry and Sally, Julia and Paul Child from the film Julie and Julia, or Sam and Annie, of course, from Sleepless in Seattle. Josh, I don't think it's a big surprise how this one came out.
No, but there was some 2 and 3, you know, could have gone any direction, I think. So Sam and Annie actually did come in last with 12%. And then Julia and Paul Child were in second place with 18%.
That's a little bit of a shocker.
Yeah, well, I thought that might happen. Like I said on the show, I hear so many people talking about that movie, and that was such a unique relationship.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Meryl Streep,
could
Stanley
see that
Tucci,
happening.
Mm-hmm. I think probably the best aspect of that film for me. So maybe not as big of a shocker, but I really thought Sleepless in Seattle would probably overtake it.
Well, people are much more attached to Harry and Sally, obviously, so they won with 70% of the vote.
Yeah, wow. That's a decisive win for Harry and Sally. That really is a great film. This week's poll question has to do with The Amazing Spider-Man, out, of course, just a few days ago for July 4th weekend, and we considered reviewing it on this week's show. Didn't quite work out with our schedule, and actually, we kind of pulled an audible, Josh, and we decided that we're going to discuss Beasts of the Southern Wild next week on the show, and then we'll get to The Dark Knight Rises. I have a feeling we'll squeeze in a few minutes about Spider-Man, maybe on that Dark Knight Rises
show. Yeah, that makes sense.
We can just group those two superhero movies together. In the meantime, we want to know where your head's at with The Amazing Spider-Man. How excited are you about the reboot of this franchise? Your options are...
Too soon, I'm skipping it. Too soon, but I can't resist Spidey. Too soon, but I can't resist Stone and Garfield. Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield, the new leads. Or, what do you mean too soon? I'm 11.
You know, if you were 11, you maybe aren't familiar with the first two great Sam Raimi films, and so this is all new to you. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Josh, where would you come in? You've already seen the film. You've, in fact, already written about the film, so you have to go back and pretend a little bit.
Right.
You are coming to this fresh. How would you have voted?
The too soon makes sense. I mean, that was my initial reaction. But at the same time, when I was a kid, Spider-Man was the superhero I was most into. So
yeah.
I can't resist Spidey.
I think that's where I would go to. Even if Emma Stone wasn't in it, and I love her, and I think she's a really talented actress. I like Andrew Garfield as well, though he isn't, for me, a huge draw. They could have probably cast just about anybody in that role. It really is the fact that it's Spidey still draws me to this film. Again, we want to know what you think. Vote now at filmspotting.net.
Okay, he was with her mom for 10 years. Had an affair with my mom, who was the secretary.
Got your mom, Lenora,
yes.
Pregnant. Married her.
Moved to London.
Moved to London.
Got bored of Lenora. And then he moved on. And then he kind of philandered around for like 7 years.
He went through his crazy Warren Beatty phase.
The funny thing, though, about those years when he was so bad with the ladies, he was so good with us, because that was...
He wasn't.
No, but that was like 6 summers that was just the three of us here.
I know, but you were okay with that. I had no respect for that. He just went... He dodged from one to the other, and it was gross.
That's Emily Blunt and Rosemarie DeWitt as sisters, actually half-sisters in the Lynn Shelton film Your Sister's Sister. And that transitions us into our top five performances of the year so far. We'll get to the men in the next segment of the show. But as we did with films last week, it's kind of nice at the halfway point of the year. It's kind of nice to take stock of everything we've seen and really assess the performances that stood out for us. Both of those performances stood out for us, especially for me, Rosemarie DeWitt, but not quite good enough to make our top five, both honorable mentions.
Honorable mentions, yeah.
Okay, well, with that, Josh, what is your number five female performance of the year?
Well, partly this list is going to mirror the top five films. I mean, so often they do go hand in hand. So I'm going to start with an actress from the film that I did list as my number five. That was The Hunger Games. It is Jennifer Lawrence. She has a seriousness and intensity that's just unyielding. And that can work against her, I think. In the X-Men film, I feel like it was just too much and it didn't seem to fit there. But it does help her stand apart in a youth market movie like The Hunger Games. If you think of who this film is being marketed towards and you think of someone like Twilight's Kristen Stewart, she can almost seem like she's posing to me in comparison to someone like Jennifer mm-hmm. Lawrence, I guess. There's just something about Lawrence that makes you feel like she shouldn't be here in this top flight Hollywood movie. And I mean that in a good way. It's not necessarily a looks thing. I mean, she's gone through so many makeovers since getting attention with Winter's Bone. So it's not a look thing, but it's just some sort of attitude, some sort of essence she has that makes her seem like an outsider. And that is perfect for the role of mm-hmm. Katniss in The Hunger Games.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a really good performance, the one that I didn't quite consider for the top five or ten. She's a really strong actress, though. As I noted last week, we reserve the right to completely change our minds and change
sure.
the order of these as we get to our end-of-year performance lists. And also, we're including supporting performances and lead performances all kind of as one rather than breaking them up a little bit. And I'm going to defy your notion that the best films and the best actors and actresses go together. They definitely often do, and they will throughout my list. But my number five actually comes from the movie that I have right now rated as my least favorite film of the year so far.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'll acknowledge that everyone needs to keep in mind, we don't see every single film that comes out. We tend to only go see the movies we have some interest in. So there's a whole lot of garbage out
there.
Yeah,
we try to avoid the ones that are pretty clearly garbage.
Right. So I'm sure there are far worse movies made than this one, but right now it's at the bottom, and it's the Tim Burton film Dark Shadows. But the performance I really love from Dark Shadows is Ava Green as Angelique Bouchard. She is the witch who turns Barnabas Collins, Johnny Depp, into a vampire because she just can't have him. Of course, people may know Ava Green better from The Dreamers, and she was a Bond girl in Casino Royale. Since then, she's been fairly quiet. She hasn't been in anything I've seen. She hasn't been in anything we've discussed on Film Spotting, obviously, but I think here in Dark Shadows, she gives a great character performance as this witch. It's a role I think a younger Helena Bonham Carter probably would have played, and she does appear in a different role in this film and is fun as well, but she just walks that Burton line where it's absolutely absurd. It could be completely cartoonish if she didn't play it as straight as she does, and she shows a theatrical side that I didn't think Ava Green probably had. I probably wrote her off as a little bit too much of a pretty face and didn't give her credit for her acting chops. I think she really shows them here in Dark Shadows.
Have you any idea what you put me through?
Barnabas, get over it.
Locked in a box for 200 years.
Don't exaggerate. It was only 196.
It was an eternity. I shall have you tried for witchcraft and burnt at the stake.
Poor sweet Barnabas. Things have changed while you were taking your little nap.
Yeah, she shows some comic ability too, which was kind of surprising from what I've seen from her before. So yeah, Dark Shadows, a bad film, but she's definitely a standout. I'd agree with that. My number four is one of the year's best films on a lot of people's lists so far. It's Moonrise Kingdom, and the performance is Frances McDormand. She plays Laura Bishop. It's a really small part. She's the mother of the 12-year-old girl who is run away married to Bill Murray, but she's also messing around with the island's police captain, who is played by Bruce Willis. It occurred to me while watching McDormand in this film is that she has a Wes Anderson face.
Yeah.
And some actors just have the sort of face that captures the comic melancholy spirit that his films also have. So it's kind of this, their faces are naturally sad. If they were just not pulling an expression, if that makes sense, they'd look sad a little bit.
Right.
But they're also wry and have a lot of comic ability there. Think of, obviously, the poster boy for this is Bill Murray. That's probably why he's been in all of Anderson's films. He has that face. Even someone like Adrian Brody in the Darjeeling Limited, I think, was a great addition, partly for his comic ability.
Kind of those droopy eyes.
But also that droopy face.
Yeah.
Yeah. And McDormand has this. But this isn't just a physical fit. I think she projects the sadness and the resignation that a lot of the adults in this movie feel. Mm-hmm. The children don't, but the adults all kind of move under the weight of this certain sadness or resignation. And she and Murray have one of the heaviest scenes, I think, in the film. They're laying in bed late at night, and it's dark, and they're just kind of talking in that marital shorthand about some of the regrets they have in terms of parenting and choices they made. And it's really a heavy scene, and it works really well because of her. So I'm glad to see her in this film. Moonrise Kingdom brought a lot of new faces into the Anderson ensemble, and she's certainly one of the stronger ones.
I'm not sure Frances McDormand's ever been bad in anything.
Well, that's probably true.
She's just a brilliant actress, and you're right, she's very good in Moonrise Kingdom. Speaking of new faces, though, my number four is a brand new face and a very young face. The actress's name is Quvenzhané Wallace.
Nice on that.
And she is the star of the film from Ben Zeitlin, Beasts of the Southern Wild. It was your number one film of the year so far. I literally just came from a screening of Beasts of the Southern Wild, and I'm very much still processing that film. But one thing I can say unequivocally is I love her performance. She is an 8-year-old actress now. She auditioned when she was 5. I'm guessing she was 6 or 7, obviously, when she performed this role. It's striking. It's startling in a lot of ways. It takes your breath away. That's really all I'm going to say about it right now, because as I said, I'm still processing it, but also we're going to get into the film next week. So for now, I'm going to let it sit. But that young actress, Quvenzhané Wallace, is really something.
Yeah, I have her as an honorable mention because I am still processing, even though I saw this a few weeks ago, and I'm just trying to figure out to what extent is it the writing that she's given. There's a lot of voiceover narration to her performance, but there's no doubt it's incredibly striking, and we'll definitely be getting into that when we review the film. My number three comes from a movie I did not care for that much, but the performance really stood out to me. It's Sarah Silverman in Take This Waltz. Take This Waltz has a lot of little pleasures. It frustrated me mostly, but I do acknowledge there are a lot of little pleasures. And one is Silverman's small role as the alcoholic sister of Seth Rogen's jilted husband. I'm going to point out the porch scene she has with Michelle Williams. She's discussing her recovery process, and I just love how she tries to find her way around the words to describe it.
I'll tell you what doesn't help me. Every book you read about it involves, you know, people falling off the wagon 8 times. So, you know, I'm good. I'm really good. But there's this looming, you know, waiting to fail-ness.
Just the way she wraps herself around those words, trying to feel her way through it, is really impressive to me. I dare say she outacts Williams in that scene. I know that's heresy to you.
It's heresy.
But,
it's
but
just blasphemous and incorrect, but that's
Williams
fine.
Has this sort of uncomfortableness in a lot of this movie, I felt, whereas Silverman is completely natural in every one of her scenes, especially that one. It's a really impressive performance that showed me something completely new from her.
I would agree with that. She's very good in that role in Sarah Pauly's Take This Waltz. You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam and Josh sharing our top 5 performances of the year so far. We're starting with the female performances of the year. And for my number 3, I think back to a conversation we had over email about our review of the movie Brave. We were searching for a top 5 to tie in with Brave, and you actually really liked the idea of doing a top 5 voice performances. And I was apprehensive because vocal performances aren't something I ever really pay a whole lot of attention to. They don't stand out for me either as brilliant or as something that detracts from the film overall. They always seem pretty solid, and I'm not sure I can think of a case where I ever really loathed a vocal performance. You disagreed, and you said that, you know, anytime a performer is basically cast for their star quality, just cast for the name, it usually ends up pretty badly. I think a lot of people would probably agree with you who have thought more about this than I have. And this is all a long way of setting up my number three pick is actually one of the vocal performances from the Pixar film Brave. It's Kelly MacDonald as the star, Princess Merida, the young girl who doesn't want to follow the traditional path her parents have set out for her. Kelly MacDonald, of course, wasn't really cast for her star quality, but she was perhaps cast a little bit for her name, at least her Scottish heritage. And she just brings a toughness and an emotional heft and a maturity that I think the movie and the character needed, but without ever losing the perspective of a young adult. However old she's supposed to be, maybe 13, 14, 15 years old, I always felt like I was watching a girl that age. But at the same time, there's just an assuredness and a maturity, as I said, to that performance. Kelly MacDonald, of course, is a great actress, and I really enjoyed every bit of her performance in Brave.
See, that's one I would put in the category of, it's certainly not a bad performance, but it's serviceable. It does the job. And I wonder how much of our enjoyment of it has to do with that thick accent that she gives her, which is, you know, it's just such a delight to hear her say those words and speak that way. And yeah, it is a good performance, but we talked about ways Brave felt a little different than a Pixar film. And I'd put the vocal performances in that category in that it just wasn't as inspired as something like Patton Oswalt in Ratatouille, for example. So I'd love to back you up on this one because I love the idea.
I definitely put MacDonald up there.
Okay.
No doubt I would.
All right. Going on to number two comes from a movie you love much more than me, Jeff Who Lives at Home. And it's the standout scene there, Judy Greer's scene. It's easily the best in the film. I think we both agree on that.
Right.
I know we've heard from other listeners who point this out. It's a scene in which Ed Helms' character confronts his wife, played by Greer, in a hotel room where she's arranged to meet another man. So Greer gets this gift here. I mean, it's so well written and it's filmed perfectly in this claustrophobic hotel room. She has this blistering speech in which her character goes off on how the husband has been a passive aggressively domineering force in their marriage and how it's driven her to this act. But the reason it rings true is not because it's this sort of up yours defiance moment, which you might expect and you'd probably get from a bigger Hollywood film. She really layers in the hurt and the suffering that's also been caused. And this is just such a raw moment in this film that so many people have already responded to. And I think a lot of that has to do with Greer making this more than a tell-off Hollywood moment.
No doubt. She's really talented. It is an amazing scene. I think the only reason I didn't really consider her for this list is she has such a small role in the film.
It is small.
Overall. But you're right. When she is on screen, she has a huge impact. My number two female performance of the year so far is the lead from Terrence Davies' The Deep Blue Sea. It's Rachel Weisz.
It looks like bits of crockery.
It's cubist.
Ah. Oh.
It's like a bra.
Bric-a-brac. That was a joke.
I gathered.
We can't all be cultured. We
can't all be childish either.
Listen, it was childish people like me that saved people like you from invasion.
Why'd you have to bring that up? It's beside the point. No one is questioning your bravery, just your mind.
We talked about this last week on the show. It was in my top five films of the year so far. She plays Hester Collier, married to a high court judge, who she leaves for the younger, more stimulating, especially sexually, Tom Hiddleston. And I think that Weisz could have made the mistake that some actors and actresses make when they play someone who is repressed and stifled, which is to play them as boring, to play them as meek and withdrawn. And Weisz doesn't underplay it or ever overplay it. She finds just that right note where I think she lets Hester's passion and her natural curiosity and anger sometimes bubble just below the surface. And even when she does lose control, Weisz never lets her completely lose control. There's a sense of self-awareness there that doesn't ever overwhelm the character, and I think just makes it a really smart performance. I've never been a huge Rachel Weisz fan, but this performance really turned me around.
Yeah, I know this one is getting a lot of praise. I'm still struggling with it, honestly. I think she's amazing in the silent moments where she's communicating everything you said without saying anything.
Right.
But this never more feels like a play than in the scenes when she and Hiddleston are talking to each other, or her character and the husband as well. To me, it just feels so script bound. And I know you talked about how you valued that they're putting emphasis on the words and the words matter. And I can see that, but somehow as a performance, it takes me out of a little bit. So I want to watch this film again because so much of it was so ravishing that I don't want to underrate it. But on a first glance, that's kind of where I'm at with her performance.
I think that's really what drew me to it was not only the use of language, but the fact that I was watching often two actors in a scene that clearly did seem like two people on a stage, and you could be taken out of it and forget that you're watching a film if it wasn't for the fact that I thought the performances were so radiant and I thought elevated it. So for me, she definitely stands out.
All right. My number one is Cécile de France from The Kid with a Bike. This is the Dardenne brothers film about an 11-year-old boy whose father has abandoned him at a government boarding school. He's repeatedly run away there. He's even attacked some of the workers. And we talked about this when we reviewed it on the show, but I love how Cécile de France's character is introduced here. Cyril, the boy, has run away again. He bursts into this doctor's office and just kind of grabs the first person he runs into as the school officials come into the room.
It's an amazing scene.
And it's her. And so the movie has been going on for a while. We haven't met her yet. This is how we meet her. And I love the memorable line she gives to him. You can hold me, but not so tight. And right there, we know that something is forming here. So this introduction echoes a strength of her performance. It's completely instinctual. That's how I interpreted her character. She comes to this boy's aid out of instinct, not out of duty, not out of altruism or anything like that. It's pure instinct. And so what that means is that we never doubt her resolution, no matter how rough things get in their relationship. And as the movie goes on and she takes him in, things do get really rough. De France makes us believe that no matter what's going to happen, she's going to see this through. Because she has no other choice, really. Mm-hmm. And so we're just completely drawn in with her.
Yeah, I really love that film, and I love that performance as well. It's one of my honorable mentions. My number one, it's a performance in a film we just disagree about, Josh. We just see it a little bit differently. The things that drove you crazy are some of the same things that really struck me about the film that worked. It is Michelle Williams as the lead in Sarah Polley's Take This Waltz. It's a little bit unfair. I feel like at this point, with me and Michelle Williams, every year you could just mark her down for a spot on this list. I think she's that good. It's a film that opens in Chicago this weekend, actually, not this past weekend. If you are in the area, it's also been playing on demand. I'm not sure if it's still there or not, but Michelle Williams plays a writer who's married to Seth Rogen, and they're really more like best friends or brother and sister than husband and wife, and she falls for the hunky rickshaw driver slash artist across the street. Part of your problem with the film
is that
you laugh about it is that you just really found the character so quirky and so annoying that it got old for you pretty quick. I get that, but I was constantly amazed by Williams' ability to draw me in rather than push me away, to make Margot flesh and blood rather than the sum of her quirks. She just never hits the same note from scene to scene, even when the emotions are vaguely the same. Michelle Williams never hits the same note. If she has a bag of tricks, there are so many options in her bag of tricks that she never has to repeat herself. She just keeps reaching in and coming out with something that knocks you over. At least it does for me. I just think she's astonishing.
Well, I'll give her this. She's trying something very different from anything else that I've at least seen her do in Take This Waltz. And I think it is more of a situation of just not being a good match or a fully written role. If she was able to sell you on this character, though,
yeah,
that's impressive.
That's how talented she is.
Up next, see if I throw Adam a Prometheus bone and name Michael Fassbender among the top five male performances of the year so far.
Don't tease me, Josh.
Stay with us.
Good night to all you late night TV watchers. And let me say good morning to you all. At the sound of my voice through this microphone line, consider that your wake-up call. My name is Billy R. Burroughs. I am not the man you think I am. Some mistake me for a writer. Some mistake me for another network man. I'm the guy who has just hijacked this channel. This telecast is now under my control. And now that I have the chance to say what's on my mind, let me tell you tales until
Josh, let's take a second to thank our very generous film spotting donors from the past week. This segment is always brought to you by Jeff Goldsmith and his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, and also his new digital magazine available on the iPad. It's called Backstory. We encourage you to search for both Backstory and The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith in iTunes. This should be a fairly quick segment this week. We pulled donations a little bit earlier than we normally do, and we want to thank all of our very generous monthly donors that are recurring donors. We don't mention them by name every week, but we did get a new $10 a month donor this week. His name, Luke McEachern in Greensboro, North Carolina.
I won't go into the normal how you have changed my life confessional, but since I started listening to the podcast last summer, my enthusiasm for film and film criticism has only deepened. Now when I go to movies with friends, our post-viewing conversations usually include a, you've been listening to those film spotting guys again, haven't you? From those who enjoy their movies straight and simple. After watching Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy for the third time, it is my pick for best film of 2011, I thought of a top five movies with essential characters who don't appear on screen. After watching the largely absent Russian spy master Carla create the damage that George Smiley is brought back to repair.
That's a great topic.
I really like that.
We're definitely going to do that at some point.
Do you have one off the top of your head?
I don't, actually.
I thought maybe Voldemort for the first few Harry Potter films,
true.
Although he kind of shows up in weird forms.
The first one,
yeah,
I think he would mostly qualify.
There's probably better ones, though. I do like that
topic. I think we could definitely do that at some point. He gives us another good one as well. My second favorite Gary Oldman role is his portrayal of a literally red meat Republican congressman in The Contender. I found Jeff Bridges' President Jackson Evans so much fun that I thought of a top five best film presidents. I know that you've already done a top five political films, but perhaps because film presidents always make the real ones seem so inadequate, I thought they might deserve their own top five. I teach American history, and when asked by my students who my favorite president is, I immediately tell them Andrew Shepard, without a hint of irony. However, I'm hoping Bill Murray will give him a run for the title as FDR in the forthcoming Hyde Park on Hudson. Luke says, thanks for turning yet another casual film goer into an appreciative amateur film critic.
Our pleasure, Luke.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the kind words about the show, the donation, and for the great top five ideas. I think we could probably break out. It might have to be a joint list, but maybe we could do a top five film presidents at some point.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, I'd consider Jeff Bridges probably from The Contender as well. Lastly, I do want to give a quick shout out to a listener, Peter Levine. I'm going to call him Levine. It might be Levine. I apologize if I'm wrong, Peter. He's in D.C. He says he's been a loyal listener for years, congratulates us on our 400th episode. And I love his note here. He says, I feel like we've been through a lot together. Maddie fake leaving the show and then actually leaving. Josh defending Cedar Rapids, Massacre Theaters, the discussion of Sallow, mentions of Grinnell College. I feel like an alum, though I went to the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And local Chicago theaters I never made it to when I grew up in its suburbs. Peter says that he's got some news to share of his own. He actually recently wrote a book. He's a straight-up fiction writer. It's a collection of short stories called The Appearance of a Hero, the Tom Mahoney Stories. It's published in August by St. Martin's Press. And he actually sent us a galley of the book and entreated us to actually read it, which probably isn't going to happen anytime soon, Peter. We apologize. Not a whole lot of time for extra reading this summer as we do the show and try to watch a million films and teach a class and all that fun stuff.
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm a notoriously slow reader, so short stories are my friend.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Maybe we will have to make time for it. But yeah, as Peter notes here, we have a lot of screenwriters and filmmakers and aspiring screenwriters and filmmakers who listen to the show and they write in and we try to plug their work as best we can. We definitely can't fit them all in. And I love getting a book in the mail from a longtime film spotting listener and certainly wish Peter all the best. Again, we want to thank everyone who donated this week, especially all of our recurring monthly donors.
For 30 years I've worked here at this TV station. In an editing room no one has ever seen. Inserting laughter after every punchline. And gasping after every scream. But now I want you to give me back the years that I have wasted.
So Fury isn't after the monster?
Not that he's told me.
Then he tells you everything.
Talk to Fury. He needs you on this.
He needs me in a cage?
No one's gonna put you in
a cage. Stop lying to me! I'm sorry. That was mean. I just wanted to see what you do.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. This week's Film Spotting Top 5, our favorite performances of the year so far. You've heard our favorite female performances. Now it's time for the men. And you just heard there, Mark Ruffalo, he's gotten a lot of acclaim for his turn as Bruce Banner in The Avengers. Is he going to make your list for The Avengers?
Someone from The Avengers is at number 5.
Okay, but not Bruce Banner.
No. It was a good performance, though. First Hulk I could get into, but... Yeah. I actually went with someone else who has been suggested by people for a different film, Tom Hiddleston. Deep Blue Sea is getting a lot of attention for. I picked him for The Avengers. When I think back on The Avengers, which I liked well enough, Hiddleston's villain, Loki, is what I remember most fondly, actually, even with that star-studded superhero cast, including Ruffalo, who we mentioned. The concern coming in was what sort of villain were they going to have that could hold his own against this massive array of superheroes? And Hiddleston wisely decided not to even try to out-muscle them. He plays Loki, as I mentioned, who we actually first met in Thor. He's Thor's power-hungry half-brother. But instead of this big muscle man, he's sort of a sniveling, contemptuous, conniving weasel. And he doesn't really have brute force. That's his weapon, is being this sort of snotty little kid almost. And I found that amusing. I thought it worked really well as a counterpoint in the movie. Hiddleston certainly is having a lot of fun with it. He brings a great level of disdain to the many speeches he gets. I like the one where he says, "It's the unspoken need of humanity. You were made to be ruled." So what Loki lacks in stature, Hiddleston makes up for in sneers.
He's a great actor. He's really good as Loki. And you can tell, though, Josh, you're betraying the fact that you're not really a comic book guy, because if you were, just like every comic book guy I've talked to about Loki, you would have used the phrase, he's a meddler.
A meddler.
They all sing off the same script. It must be in the actual text of the comic somewhere. He's a meddler.
That's the official term, huh?
That's the official term, apparently, for what Loki is. And you know what? That's fine. I'll buy that. And I'll buy, as I said, that Tom Hiddleston is very good. I'm still not convinced that Loki is in any way, shape, or form a compelling villain. I need someone a little bit more than a meddler. But he's very good. I'm with you on the pick of Tom Hiddleston. We are sharing our top 5 male performances of the year so far. Again, these will include both supporting and lead turns, though for me, it will only include supporting performances. The first time ever, Josh, in the history of this mid-year list, that the 5 performances that most stood out for me were all supporting performances. And there's one name that's going to come up that won't surprise anybody, but the other 4 have never appeared on a mid-year or end-of-year performance list for me, and 2 actors I'd never even seen or heard of before these performances. So I'm kind of excited to share some of these names. Number 5 is a fairly familiar name. It's Liev Schreiber from the hockey movie Goon. He plays Ross Ray, an enforcer. This is a film written by Jay Baruchel and Evan Goldberg. It stars Sean William Scott as a bouncer who can barely skate, looking for his passion, looking for his calling in life, something he can commit to, and he gets recruited to join a minor league hockey team and just be the guy to take a punch and punch out other guys to defend his teammates. And Liev Schreiber is kind of the figure in some ways he aspires to be. He's the league tough guy, this legendary figure. And they have a fantastic scene in a diner where we've just seen Ross Ray basically in highlight footage just destroying people on the ice. They finally get to meet face to face and have this great conversation.
You're a tough little out there. You could bang.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
So I'm going to impart some of the wisdom of my years on you.
And I could really use some of that.
Everybody loves the soldiers until they come home and stop fighting. You understand what I'm saying?
I don't know, no.
Kid, you got this thing. The stuff. You got it, like me. But like me, that's all you got. And like me, you're no good to anyone doing anything else. All I'm saying is don't go trying to be a hockey player. You get your heart ripped out.
I don't think Liev Schreiber is probably the first guy most of us would think of for this part. He's certainly physically imposing enough, but this is a guy who does Shakespeare in the Park, and he just manages to give Ross a really tragic dimension and a depth that not only elevates the movie, but is absolutely realistic, too. Oftentimes, the enforcer on a hockey team is the guy who really is the smartest and most intellectual about it, because they're not there just playing a game. They understand their role. There is something almost cerebral about what they're there to do on the ice, even if it is just to punch other guys out. And so you see Liev Schreiber, and you realize that even though, as I said, he's kind of a big guy, but he's not that imposing. Nevertheless, he's such a good actor, and he speaks with such fierce conviction that he scares the hell out of you when he opens his mouth.
That's it. I'm watching Goon very soon because I've been looking for my inspired dumb comedy of the year, and I just – Dictator failed me. Ted, I enjoyed. But, yeah, maybe this is it.
Goon might work. Sean William Scott actually is good in it as well. I thought he was hilarious in Role Models, the David Wayne film. And Allison Pill plays a love interest in the movie. At first, you almost don't even recognize her. You certainly wouldn't think of Allison Pill either as a quote-unquote puck bunny who falls in love with hockey players, but she's fantastic in Goon as well.
My number four, I'm going to stick on the Channing Tatum bandwagon with Magic Mike.
Really?
I know Michael Phillips expressed his doubt. He doubted both of us on last week's show, but I'm going to stick with Tatum. Magic Mike wasn't evidence of his range. I'll admit that, as much as it was a reminder of the effortless presence he has in his best performances. And maybe it's because he played this part to a degree already in his life. He's the stripper at night here. But Tatum's Mike felt like the most authentic screen character of the year to me. I felt like if you hung out in Tampa's bar scene, you'd run into this guy, for sure. The dance scenes also are being overlooked. It's as if they don't count as acting, but how many times do we talk about Fred Astaire? And I'm not putting him in that category, but the dancing is kind of being set aside for some reason that I don't quite get. That final performance he gives in the movie really communicates a lot about where Mike is at emotionally, what the dancing has meant to him beyond the cash and the ego boost. You see how this is actually a form of self-expression for him. So why can't Tatum's dancing skills be considered part of his range?
I agree. I think he's really good in the movie, and I think his dancing should be lauded as well. Great pick. My number four male performance of the year so far is another pick from the movie Take This Waltz. I really enjoyed Luke Kirby. Luke Kirby.
You have got to be kidding
me. I'm not kidding you at all. He's the Canadian actor who is the hunky rickshaw driver slash artist who beguiles Michelle Williams in that Sarah Pauly film.
You're going to have Jake Johnson on this list next, aren't you?
Don't spoil
Everyone
it.
Everyone who's annoyed me this
Don't
year is on
it.
Your list.
That's what I'm going for. That was my only goal with my top five, Josh. But everything I said about Michelle Williams in the segment about great female performances really does apply more or less to Luke Kirby's performance as well. Rather than being overwhelmed by the quirkiness, he made him as real as a rickshaw driver slash artist can feel, and he did surprise me from moment to moment. I think, Josh, the degree of difficulty in the scene where he's having a drink, I think it's martinis with Michelle Williams, and he says something about what he would do to her. And it just,
he says about 6,000 things
about
what he would do to her.
But it just sort of lingers in the air as if, has he crossed a line? Is she going to push him on this? She does push him. She says, I want to know what you're going to do to me.
I just kissed the top of your head. Ever so gently.
You did?
Yes. And then I kissed your eyelids. And they fluttered underneath my lips. Just a little.
A little.
And very, very slowly, I just grazed your lips with mine. But because you're married, I didn't dare kiss them.
I think that scene is a real challenge for an actor to pull off, where you have to be raw and erotic, but at the same time never be puerile, and I think he really kills it. That's one of the scenes that I think will either drive some people away from Take This Waltz, or it will make you embrace it even more. That's one that really brought me into the film. He mainly shines in that scene, but they're both really wonderful. Some amazing reaction shots from Michelle Williams in that sequence.
Yeah, I think you're right about that scene, and I think you're right about this is really something you respond to instinctively. Either you're going to buy these characters or you're not, and so to what degree do the performances matter? Really, I mean, they sold the characters for you, so they worked for you. My number three comes from a film you mentioned on your list for female performances. I'm choosing the male performer. It's Dwight Henry in the lead in Beasts of the Southern Wild. Henry was a novice. He worked in the bakery across from the production offices in New Orleans for the film. And so he had no real experience when he was cast as the wildly unpredictable father of Quvenzhané Wallace's character, Hush Puppy, who you put on your list. This is set in an impoverished but defiant lowland community that has refused to move to higher ground, and Henry's Wink and his daughter Hush Puppy are barely surviving there. There are some highly charged dramatic scenes here between them, and I think you can feel Henry straining a little bit in some of them. You can see that. But mostly what came through to me is this father's terror at the thought that he's the only one there to protect his daughter, and not only that, that he knows he's not good at it. He might not be up to it. He's an alcoholic. He's not instinctively loving. One of the most heartbreaking lines in the film is when Hush Puppy says, "I can count all the times I've been lifted on two fingers." Yet, despite those faults, Wink understands this responsibility. He doesn't run from it. Instead, he kind of fumbles his way trying to figure it out till the end. It's really something to watch.
It is something to watch, and certainly we will get into it a little bit more next week on the show as we discuss Beasts of the Southern Wild. You're listening to Film Spotting, Adam and Josh revealing our top five male performances of the year so far. And my number three from the movie Safety Not Guaranteed. Say it with me, Josh. Say it proud.
I don't know if I can do it. Jake, I can't bring myself to do it.
Jake M. Johnson. He is, I think I can say this, the douchey magazine reporter who brings Aubrey Plaza and another intern with him in search of the man who wrote the ad seeking a companion for time travel. You think you've got this guy pegged, but I think that director Colin Trevorrow, the writer Derek Connolly, and Jake Johnson, the actor, they defy you at every turn to hate this guy. I'd never want him as my mentor, but I was happy every time he came on screen. He delivers some hilarious moments, and he gets redeemed in a way that never completely excuses his character. You can't appreciate the depth of that performance, Josh, but I can. I think it's quite a trick to be that likably unlikable. And as I talked to Lynn Shelton, the director of Your Sister's Sister, who has a very small role in this film, and directed Jake Johnson in episodes of New Girl on TV, the Zooey Deschanel series, she raves about him. Colin Trevorrow raves about him. Mark Duplass raves about him.
Listen to you
him.
Calling in all the big guns
right.
Now as support.
They know what they're talking about. Even if I don't, he's the real deal. And you can see him on TV on New Girl, which I haven't started watching yet. But you're going to see a lot more of Jake Johnson.
You're projecting great things.
I am.
Well, he may be just fine. This is the first I've seen of him, but
me
I
too.
Didn't buy this character at all. I didn't buy the transformation, despite the fact that I saw it coming from the first scene. And the problem is, if you see the transformation as false and well projected, then all you get is the jerkiness. So there was no level there. We've talked about this before, so we'll just have to leave it at that, and we'll see where Jake Johnson goes from here.
We will, and I'll love for listeners to get a chance to see Safety Not Guaranteed, and I can't wait for all the emails when that movie comes out on DVD. All the emails pouring in telling me, man, you're right, this Jake Johnson is something, because it's going to happen, Josh.
We'll see about that.
Okay.
My number two, I'm going to have a hard time pronouncing this, tried to look it up, Muhammet Uzuner, I believe, from Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, the Turkish film. There's no main character in this expansive interior epic, but the doctor played by Uzuner is the closest thing we have to an audience surrogate, I believe. This doctor has been called to join a police entourage that's being led by a murder suspect who can't quite remember the place where a body has been hastily buried. The doctor has the grisly duty of confirming the body. So for much of the film, the doctor is sort of a listener, a watcher. This is a very interior performance, and a lot of it is going on strictly in the eyes. Uzuner is uninvolved at the start, almost disinterested. You can tell he doesn't really want to get too into this, but they gradually grow into this heavy awareness that we can feel. So Uzuner lets us in on the character's thought process somehow. When he makes a final decision while performing an autopsy at the end, the entire story clicked into place for me and made me realize how much I was with him all along.
Yeah, he really is remarkable in the film, and I would actually put Taner Bursell as the prosecutor up there with him, another great performance in that movie, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. My number two male performance of the year so far is, no shocker here, my guy Michael Fassbender.
There we go.
David in Ridley Scott's Prometheus. You knew it was coming. He's David, or he's Pinocchio if Pinocchio harbored a desire to kill Geppetto. That's basically who Michael Fassbender is in this movie. We've talked about this film a lot, probably too much, but I love the ambiguity of his droid character. He's both the antagonist in some ways to the people on this mission, but he's also the most interesting, perhaps sympathetic character in the film. I certainly think he's the most complex character in the movie, and there's just elements of precision in his performance and his movement of his speech that reflects the fact that he's not real, but there's also that slight, sinister vulnerability and humanity that really comes through in his performance.
Fassbender is very good in Prometheus.
Thank you for saying something nice about Prometheus, Josh.
I'll leave it at that.
Well done.
My number one, Jack Black, the title role in Bernie. I think I took this performance for granted the first time I saw it. And since then, I've seen bits of Black and stuff like High Fidelity. I was watching a bit of that. Also saw him perform on Stephen Colbert recently with Tenacious D. And it really hit me what a bravura departure this was for Black. Bernie is based on the true crime tale directed by Richard Linklater, and Black's Bernie is this genuinely sweet, likely gay, and deeply religious assistant funeral director in the small town of Carthage, Texas. He gets into a well-intentioned relationship with a much older widow, and that soon turns abusive and ugly, leading to something I'd rather not give away. We're never quite sure what to make of Bernie, but that's kind of the movie's point. So Black is walking a very fine line here. He has to play the part straight, not as a joke, but still somehow acknowledge the absurdity of this so strange, it must be true tale. I think a good example of this are the scenes of Black singing the hymns.
Angels descending, bring from above, echoes of mercy, whispers of love. This is my story, this is my song, praising my Savior all the day long. This is my story, this is my song, praising my Savior all the day long. Please be seated.
I really enjoyed these scenes, and there's a lot of them, actually. They're lightly comic, but they're also beautifully sung by Black, and we can get this sense of Bernie's genuine intent while singing them. You know, he really believes this stuff, but it also allows us to see that they're a little odd because this isn't the whole Bernie that we're hearing here. This is kind of one side of him. How authentic is it? Such a complicated part. Bernie is an enigma. That's so hard to do, and I really think Black nails it.
Yeah, he definitely does nail it. Jack Black was someone I strongly considered for my list. Great pick. As if you didn't hate my list enough already, some of my picks just not working for you, you're really going to love the fact that my number one is a cheat.
Oh, boy.
I have a tie for my number one, Josh, but just hear me out on this. I promise that at the end of the year, they won't be there. I'll split them up. I'll force myself to choose. But I'm going to give myself a little bit of wiggle room here at the mid-year point because I really just can't choose between these two actors in this film. You already mentioned one of them. Tom Hiddleston as Loki in The Avengers made your list. I've got Tom Hiddleston from The Deep Blue Sea and Simon Russell Beale. So you've got the actor who plays her husband. You've got the love interest she has an affair with in Tom Hiddleston. And I just kept wanting to hate Beale's Sir William because he's constantly acquiescing to his overbearing mother. He's so concerned with propriety. He seems stiff and intellectual, but as the film goes on, Beale shows him kind of to be a victim of circumstance as well, just like Hester, and someone who without spite genuinely has his wife's best interests at heart. And I really came to appreciate his character and the performance. And then with Hiddleston, he plays the lover Freddie who can never quite be the man that she wants him to be. You've got an actor, it just occurred to me as I was watching it, from scene to scene, he's one of those guys who's clearly classically trained, who I feel like you could just throw in to any situation, whatever the scene calls for. You got to do this, this, and this. He walks in, great, nails all three, time for lunch, let's have a cup of tea. He just can do it. It's just that natural to Tom Hiddleston. I can't imagine anything phasing him on a set. He just seems so in control of his emotions at all times. And I love both men here. So just like Hester has problems choosing, I'm not going to choose, Josh. It's my tie number one.
I will force you to choose eventually, but for now, I'm giving you credit for remembering Beale because that's not going to happen.
He's so good.
As these two, he's very good. And as these two performances, the leads, Weiss and Hiddleston, go on through the rest of the year, they're going to be getting awards talk, I'm sure, if it's just that kind of picture, those kind of performances. Beale's going to certainly be forgotten. So glad you mentioned him.
He probably will be, unfortunately. And as we've talked a little bit about The Deep Blue Sea the past couple of weeks, I'll note again, it comes out on DVD later this month, July 24th, for folks wanting to check it out. Our buddy Scott Tobias from the AV Club actually wrote the DVD liner essay.
Very nice.
Asked by Music Box Films to do that. So great honor for him. I know he's really excited and is a big fan of that film. Those are our top five performances of 2012 so far. Josh, do you want to quickly list any honorable mentions from the female and male side?
Yeah, I think most of them have been brought up. Rosemary DeWitt and Emily Blunt in Your Sister's Sister. Quvenzhané Wallace, still trying to figure out that performance in Beasts of the Southern Wild, and also Rachel Weisz. As for the men, I really want to mention Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins in Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah,
the comic duo there, just hysterical. Bruce Willis, Moonrise Kingdom, another sad Wes Anderson face. Loved him as an addition. And then I did appreciate Michael Fassbender. Also, another film I didn't like so much but appreciated the performance, Safety Not Guaranteed. I thought Mark Duplass was wonderful there.
Well, some good picks there. We have some more overlap for me on the female side. Rosemarie DeWitt from Your Sister's Sister, Cecile DeFrance, who made your list from The Kid with the Bike, and a film that we both agreed we didn't really like, but we split on one of the lead performances in it. The movie is Sound of My Voice, Britt Marling, an actress I really like as a cult leader. I think she's very good in that film, but I also really appreciated Nicole Vicious, who plays the girlfriend to the journalist-type character who goes in to make this documentary about this cult. I should note that Greta Gerwig in Damsels in Distress, the Whit Stillman film, is getting a lot of acclaim so far this year, but that's a film that I still haven't had a chance to catch up with as it's not out on DVD yet, so she didn't make my list. On the male side, I'm with you on Jack Black in Bernie. I'm also with you on Mark Duplass in Safety Not Guaranteed. Muhammad Uzunur from Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. The other two picks you didn't mention, though, Mark Wahlberg in Ted, very funny.
I thought about that, yeah.
And Thomas Doré, the kid with the bike, the young boy in that film from the Dardenne brothers, I think is really fantastic as well. We certainly want to know what some of the standout performances of the year so far were for you. You can send us your picks or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. Or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out wide this weekend, or actually out already, The Amazing Spider-Man came out Tuesday. Katy Perry, Part of Me came out Thursday. And this weekend, the new Oliver Stone movie, Savages, is out. In limited release, the new Sarah Polley film, Take This Waltz, certainly came up a few times here throughout this show. It opens in Chicago. We thought it opened last weekend. Turns out it's this weekend. And if you get a chance to check out the Film Spotting apps for Android or for iPhone, you can hear myself and Josh and our guest Michael Phillips last week spend a good 20 minutes or so really diving into that movie. You can get more information by going to filmspotting.net and clicking on apps. Also out in limited release, speaking of the Duplass brothers, the Dodeca Pentathlon, the Norwegian comedy Turn Me On, Damn It, and Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is the film we'll talk about next week on the show. Our top five is still a little bit up in the air. We're going to try to tie in to Beast, maybe a little bit go with something weather-related.
Possibly. I mean, that movie is so weird. There are a million different directions we could go. If anyone's seen it, maybe they've got some ideas.
Yeah, I'd love to hear them. And also, we're going to get back to our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon with Jafar Panahi's The Mirror.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was M. Ward. Learn more at mwardmusic.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Listen, I'd love to hear more about Christopher. Bonus content? That is very disturbing, I have to add.
Well, I had four sisters. And my
remind me again, older or younger?
All younger. I'm the oldest.
Not an excuse, then.
I had four. I'm not saying there's an excuse. I had four sisters, and one Christmas, it was the Christmas of Cabin
Patch
Kids.
Oh, I remember.
Kids, you know,
oh, yeah.
Four or something around there.
There was bedlam in the toy store aisles for those
things.
My
mom got a Cabbage Patch Kid for all my sisters. And, well, at that time, I wouldn't have had four sisters. I would have only had three sisters, I think. She got them for all my sisters and, for whatever reason, decided that the kids should get
didn't
one.
Didn't want you to feel didn't left out. That was nice
me.
Of her. Yeah.
Okay, here we go.
Probably warped you in ways that have yet to be revealed. But
well, we'll see if we get into it in this review.